Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. And I'm very excited about this guest because she sold over a million copies of her book. She has many of them. And I'm all about psychology and being mentally strong. If you listen to this podcast, you know that it really starts with yourself. If you can become strong, then you can lead and manage others. And so it starts with the self. If you want to change the world, change yourself first. And this individual has a book out there that is, it seems like it's for every niche. There's one that's targeted for kids, women, men, everybody. So I'm going to give a quick little background, a little bio of her. It's pretty damn impressive. Amy Morin is a licensed clinical social worker, college psychology instructor, and psychotherapist. She's one of the most popular TEDx speakers of all time. Her talk, The Secret of Becoming Mentally Strong, has been viewed more than 22 million times. She's also the award-winning host of a podcast called Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin. I could go on and on, but the book we're going to be talking about today is called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. Take back your power, embrace change, face your fears, and train your brain for happiness and success. Amy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So let's go back to the genesis of this book. From what I'm reading, it really just started off as a blog post or a LinkedIn post, and it just went viral. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it actually started off as a letter to myself. One of the worst days of my life as a therapist who had gone through losses. I had lost my husband. I lost my mother. I felt like I was absolute bottom of the barrel. I was about to lose my father-in-law. And I just thought, you know, boy, what next? So I wrote myself a letter about what mentally strong people don't do, basically to get through the day. And I found it helpful. So I thought maybe somebody else would too. I put it on the internet on a website called lifehack.org. And it got 50 million views. It got picked up by Forbes and Business Insider and all sorts of huge media outlets. And so within a couple of days, MTV in Finland called and CNN in Mexico and all of these people. And they all assumed I wrote it because I'd mastered the list and really nobody knew I wrote it out of a place of pain, that I actually wrote it to myself. I didn't mean for it to go viral and certainly never intended to become an author. But one of the people who read the article happened to be a literary agent who suggested I write a book. And that's why 10 years later, I still get to do cool stuff like talk to you. And I've now written 6 books on mental strength and get to do lots of other things other than just sitting in the therapy office these days.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So 8,500 reviews. I interview authors from all over the world. And that is in the top 2 or 3% that I've seen. So incredible work. It's definitely resonating. So that's the genesis. Can you give us or maybe provide some insight on the top 3 takeaways from the book? Maybe your first 3 or the ones that have really landed in your audience.
Sure. So number 1 on the list was don't feel sorry for yourself, which that's where I was in the moment when I wrote it and needed that reminder myself. But for all of us, whenever we go through something difficult, maybe you get rejected or you fail at something, it's easy to start thinking like, nobody likes me. I'm never going to have anything good happen. All of these bad things always happen to me. And that's when our healthy sadness crosses over into self-pity. Super unhealthy, keeps us stuck, because if you convince yourself that your problems are so big you can't change, you'll stay stuck in a place of pain. So that's number 1. Let yourself feel sad, but if you start crossing over to the area of self-pity, scale it back. Make sure that you don't let yourself go there.
Number two, to touch on that, I found pretty impressive from Tony Robbins' talk, obviously Tony Robbins is like the GOAT when it comes to motivation, but he did say something along the lines of, when you're feeling bad or feeling depressed or, you know, you have low self-esteem, it's because you've deselected certain happiness out of your life. So it's almost like you can, if you're sad, it means you're discounting all the good things in your life. And if you're happy, you're kind of discounting all the bad things in your life. So when a rejection hits home, it's almost like, yeah, I might have the life, the family, the money, all that, but this one little piece is not set. So I'm going to focus only on this. And it's really all about what you focus on. So the more you focus on your, you know, pitying yourself, the more it kind of grows is the way I look at it. And you're kind of discounting all of the great stuff. So focus on the great stuff. Great point there.
Well, you know, and I guess I actually don't say you should focus on all the great stuff. I think it's healthy to be sad. That's really healing. Grief is part of the process by which we heal. You want to honor that sadness. Being sad means I had something so important in my life, and I'm honoring the fact that I no longer have it. Wow. So I think it's important to be sad, and you can let yourself be sad and happy at the same time. You might be sad about leaving something behind, but happy about the next chapter in your life. So I think feelings are much more complex than perhaps the Tony Robbins quick motivational version, but great analogy anyway.
Wow. So yeah, you're right. I see where you're coming from, where sometimes, I mean, this pain and sadness, we have these emotions for a reason, right? I always think that anger, right? People always think anger is a bad thing. Well, anger used properly is the greatest source of fuel potentially to do great things. And so if you have these feelings, maybe they're there to teach you something, but also it shows how significant X, Y, or Z was to you. And that is something that you should respect. It's pretty powerful. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So another big one in the book is don't give away your power. And this one is about saying the language that we use sometimes. We'll say somebody wasted my time. Somebody ruined my day. Somebody made me feel bad about myself. Taking back your power is just realizing, no, I'm in charge of how I think, how I feel, how I behave. I can decide what I'm going to do with my time today, who I spend it with. And even when we say something like, my boss makes me feel bad, or my boss makes me work late, like they didn't make you work late. That was a choice. And taking back your power sometimes is just recognizing, okay, I didn't want to work late, but I knew the consequence if I didn't was maybe I'll get fired. But just that slight shift in language of I'm choosing to do this, not I have to do it, makes a huge difference to your psychological well-being.
I like it. Yeah. So it reminds me of a Robert Greene book, you know, the 52 Laws of Power. But basically, you have the choice to give it up, right? Basically.
Right.
And what you're saying is that individuals, whenever they're at a low point, they give away all their power. Is that what you've realized?
Even people, I think, at a high point, right? When you're doing well in life, it's easy to then be like, you know, you don't have to worry about what you're going to eat or where you're going to live, but it's easy to still blame somebody else. Like my mother-in-law wasted 2 hours of my life complaining. No, she didn't waste 2 hours of your life. You let her take it. And that small thing, like you can tell somebody, hey, this doesn't serve me well. I'm not going to continue the conversation. You can walk away from something. You don't have to go to that party and then blame people for throwing a bad party. Just don't go or leave early.
Man, I believe life gives you only what you put up with. So what you're saying is that if you allow people to treat you like an option or push you around or do certain things that just don't make you feel right, it's your fault, right? It's not their fault. It's you allowing it to happen is like the universe seeing that and saying, oh, well, if these are your standards and they're that low, I'm going to keep giving you certain things in your life until you say enough is enough.
Yes. And we know, strangely, from the research that people with low self-esteem actually attract people that put them down. So if I feel bad about myself, I'm going to attract people that reinforce my beliefs. So therefore, I'm going to be friends with people who perhaps insult me, who make fun of me. And then I think, well, you know, nobody's nice to me. Well, you know why they're not? Because we're being around, surrounding ourselves with people who are mean or rude. And part of it is I need to work on myself. I can't change how other people treat me. But if I feel better about myself, I'll start to choose people, better people in my life who treat me better.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess that's it. And maybe it's because they don't feel worthy. Is that what it is? Like you don't feel worthy of being treated well. I mean, I've heard many psychologists say, you know, there's that great analogy of, you know, whenever there's like a $20 bill and then you crinkle it up, you know, and you push it around and then you pull it up. Like, well, how much is this still worth? Right. Everybody's like, well, $20, no matter what you go through. But many people look at that and say it's been devalued. So if they go through something difficult or if they can't handle themselves well, they kind of devalue themselves and therefore they say, I'm not worthy of X, Y, and Z anymore. Therefore, I'll allow people to treat me that way.
Right. Because if I feel awful about myself and you say lots of kind things about me, that actually feels super uncomfortable because I'm like, no, I think I'm an idiot. And here you are saying, wow, you're so smart. If those two things don't line up, I don't like that. So I'm actually not going to spend that much time with you. I'm going to choose the people who reinforce the fact that I'm not intelligent or that I'm not good enough.
Ooh, that's good. So that's two. What's the third one?
I would say not giving up after failure, the first failure. As a therapist, so many people come into my office and they'll say, you know, like I tried to lose weight and I couldn't do it, so I'm not going to do it again. Or I started a business and it really didn't work out, so therefore I don't dare try. And And it's really the fear of failure that they have to get over. They think they're not smart enough, they're not good enough, but often it's just that fear of being rejected, the embarrassment of failing, the idea that I can't handle one more failure. And because of that, they think it wasn't meant to be, and they conclude, I can't try again because clearly I'm going to fail. And with that attitude, we often make it true. If you believe you can't do something, then you really won't do it. So super important to know that when we see success stories, there's rarely a person who succeeds without failing a million times. We think that people were an overnight success or that it just came easy to them. And one of my favorite studies is when they looked at high school science students. Teachers originally thought, we'll tell them about Einstein and Edison and all the amazing things that these people have done, and that will inspire the students. Well, the more that they talked about successful people, the more the kids' grades actually went down. And then as soon as they started sharing, well, you know, Edison invented a lot of things that you've never heard of because he failed at them, their grades actually started going back up because they realized it's okay to take a chance. If I don't know, I can still try. And if I'm not sure of the answer, I can still try to come up with something. I don't just have to determine that I'm a failure. So I think that's really important sometimes. Study famous failures, how they failed and then how they recovered. And I think it works for adults too, that we then put ourselves out there and we start to do a lot better when we look at that, rather than just reading about people's last minute success. Learn about their failures all along the way.
So it was my sixth business, I would say, that actually made me some money. So the first one was real estate. I made a little bit of money, and then I got into startups and I failed miserably four times. And the fifth one made a little bit more. And then my sixth one, I guess you could say, is the publishing company. So people ask me, like, well, how did you stay at it even after the second or third failure when you're at $300,000 in debt? And so I just kept thinking to myself, well, there's no other way. There's no other option. If I give up, I will regret it. So I think it was the fear of regret that kept me pushing forward. Yeah. Do you see any type of trend of why people are able to run through those flames and keep going at failure after failure, but not losing the enthusiasm?
Yeah, I think sometimes it has to do with our emotional state. So we know when we're sad, let's say you're kind of depressed in life, you're much less likely to go after something a second time, even if it's a negotiation. Let's say I am sad about something that happened yesterday, and I want to sell you a pencil today, and I think my pencil's worth $10, and you offer me $5, I'm much more likely to take $5 than if I were in a really good mood. If I were happy today, I'd be like, you know, you offer me $5, I'm going to be all, no, how about $9.50? Because I'm like, yes. My ego can handle rejection a little bit more if I feel good about who I am and I'm kind of happy today. So just knowing your emotional state, there's tons of research behind this, but your emotional state really plays into that. So if I think I can't handle one more rejection and I failed at getting the first promotion, I'm going to be like, I can't do it again. I'm not going to apply for another one because my ego can't handle it. So sometimes it's just about knowing that we're more capable and competent than we give ourselves credit for, and to pay more attention to our emotions. Like, what do I feel right now? And how's that playing into my decision making? You know, on the flip side, if you're angry or you're embarrassed, let's say something incredibly embarrassing happened to you, you're much more likely to take a huge risk. Or if you're excited about something, this is why really smart people fall prey to a get-rich-quick scheme, because they were excited, right? So just paying attention to your emotions. So when it comes to failure, like, do you think it is the worst thing in the world and you feel like you can't handle another rejection? If so, you're not going to try again.
Oh, that's a great point there. What I realized is I have this default position that anytime something negative happens, I have to use that to propel myself forward, whether it's in that area or somewhere else. So, you know, I look at every setback or rejection as, okay, what is this teaching me? What do I have to learn from it? And how can I use this to have the courage to put myself out there? Whenever I was struggling financially with my publishing business, I said, all right, I need to kind of toe the line. Let me put some marketing materials that I probably would not even think of beforehand. But now I have a little bit more of a chip on my shoulder, something to prove. Let's go all the way with this, right? So maybe I was embarrassed because I was failing, but it allowed me to say, all right, in order for me to really go over the top, let me put myself out there in a way that that just seemed like it was insane even 6 months ago. So is that what you're saying, that you've noticed that amongst the mentally strong people, that they use these setbacks as sort of launching pads?
Yeah, I think it could depend, right? So if somebody says, I feel embarrassed, One person's strategy then is like, I can't handle feeling embarrassed again, so I'm not going to tolerate this feeling. Somebody who can cope with embarrassment says, all right, I'm embarrassed today that this failed, but watch me next week when I go ahead and crush it. And I'm going to, and they're able to turn it into that. So it's really about, I think, that self-awareness of how do I feel and how can I use this emotion as a strategy to move forward? And some people will say, you know, I failed at this, but I'm going to do twice as good tomorrow, or this is going to be an amazing comeback story. And knowing that a setback, a rejection could turn into something where you're like, all right, this didn't turn out the way I wanted right now, but someday when it does turn out much better than I even am expecting, this is going to make a great story of how it didn't work out the very first time I tried.
Mm. Now this TEDx talk, I have to talk to you about this. I'm trying to go for a TEDx presentation.
Oh, good.
So I'm meeting with a guy, I think in 2 weeks, to potentially put one together. And how did that all come about? I mean, obviously the article went insane, the book went insane. What was that, experience like? And, what came from it, I guess?
So after the article came out the end of 2013, I got the book deal in January of 2014. And the book came out by the end of 2014. And I had already started to get speaking engagement opportunities. I was a social worker in rural Maine. I had spoken to maybe 25 people in like a church basement and had never been on a big stage. And so the very first speaking invitation I got was on stage with Gary Vee. I went to it and I had no idea like that people even went to these giant conferences and things like that. So I did okay, I think, for the very first time, but then immediately knew I had to do something to up my game. So hired a speaking coach. And I'm thrilled that I did. And that was early 2014. And then a couple of months later, I got an email from a TEDx that said, hey, we'd love for you to come do an event with us, and decided, all right, I'm going to do it and let's see what will happen. But actually did two. And the first TEDx I did, I basically gave the same speech twice. The first TEDx talk I gave, the microphone broke halfway through. And I had a different title. The first one is called Letting Go of What Holds You Back. And the second one, almost the same speech, word for word, is called The Secret of Becoming Mentally Strong. I think the first one has 60,000 views. The second one is now up to somewhere over 23 million views. So the title matters a lot, as does the audio quality. But obviously, from 23 million views on that, it's led to so many more speaking opportunities and lots of other engagements and things like to be able to be on your podcast. Things like that have certainly come out of doing that one speech for 15 minutes. And obviously you don't get paid to do a TEDx. And most of the time I say no to things where people say, we don't have a budget. But this is one where it definitely makes sense to do it for the exposure.
Absolutely. Yeah, man, that's exciting. I got to go check out this speech. You talked about studies and experiments, and I'm just fascinated with, certain studies that Jordan Peterson references within his book and how rats are more motivated by fear than wants. You mentioned one. Is there any other that's on the top of your mind that you could share with our audience? I just love these type of studies that show how the human brain works.
Oh, well, I'll give you an experiment that everybody can try that I think is fascinating. And you need a friend to try this one, but you'll see how your brain works and how much the belief about what you can do affects you. So basically, find somebody, a partner, somebody else that you can do this exercise with. You have them hold their arm out to the side and you push it down on their arm and have them resist so that they don't push it down. And people can do that pretty easily. You're not going to push down on their arm. They can hold it out there to the side. Then have them put their arm down and say out loud 10 times, I'm a weak and worthless person. And you can keep track, count for them till you get to 10. So the other person says, I'm a weak and worthless person. I'm a weak and worthless person. Have them put their arm back up and you're going to push down on it, but tell them to resist. They can't. You're able to push their arm down because they said out loud, I'm a weak and worthless person, and their brain believed it. So then don't leave them like that. Have them do it 10 more times. Have them say, I'm a strong and worthwhile person. Have them hold their arm out again when they're done after the 10th time. And you push down on their arm. You can't do it again. And you think this is one of those things where, because I'll tell people, it's one thing for me to tell people, the words out of your mouth matter. But when you can show somebody this, and when you watch it happen, because you're going to think, no, this doesn't work. This is stupid. But our brains believe it so much that our body does. And this is an example of, I gave you a sentence to say. This wasn't even a sentence that you normally would say to yourself. You probably have other horrible names you say or horrible things you say to yourself every once in a while. This is one I gave you. So it's not even something that you necessarily believed, but saying it out loud 10 times affects your body so much that you can't hold your arm out when somebody pushes down. And just, I think that's one of, for me, the most powerful experiments you could do, just to see for yourself how powerful the words that come out of your mouth are.
Unbelievable. Now, what is that? Is that just because we are fortune tellers, whether we realize it or not? Whatever we say, there's power behind the words that we say out loud and believe. And so our soul is really trying to make everything that we say to ourselves and out loud come true. Or is it just making it well known to the brain that if you believe that you are going to fail, you're going to fail? If you're going to walk on that stage and you say to yourself, I'm going to crush it, you're going to crush it. It's almost act as if rather than, you know, yeah, maybe that's the best way to put it, is you're acting as if it already happened. So you have a state of abundance, if you will.
Yeah, the thing is, I think your muscles will believe what your brain says. So when your brain says to your arm, you can't possibly do this because you're too weak to do it, your arm doesn't, it's like you don't even try as hard. You don't put as much effort into it. And we know that it's okay to have some self-doubt. Athletes who have a little bit of self-doubt outperform people who step in there and they're like, I've completely got this because I don't need to try. You put in more effort when you have a little bit of self-doubt. So it's okay to have self-doubt sometimes. So when you step on the stage and you think, oh, I'm not 100% confident, like that's okay. You don't want to erase all of your self-doubt. But on the other hand, when you step up on the stage, you also don't want to make your goal to like, I hope I just don't embarrass myself. You'll perform much differently if you say, I am here because I have a message to put out to the audience and I can't wait to tell them what it is, the knowledge I have that I want to share. You'll perform differently. Like Tom Brady didn't step out onto the football field like, hope we don't embarrass ourselves today, right? And he was there to win. And so to be say, yeah, I'm here to win. And maybe you have a little bit of self-doubt and that's okay. But when you know, like, this is my goal, is to just not embarrass myself, guaranteed you'll do it differently. But in my therapy office, I see people like that all the time who will say, I have a job interview coming up. Well, what's your goal? Ugh, I just don't want to say anything stupid. You'll perform so much differently in that job interview if you go in there thinking, I don't want to say anything stupid, as opposed to, I'm going to say some stuff that's going to impress people, and I'm going to say things that showcase my knowledge. You'll talk differently the entire time, I guarantee it.
Mm, that's so important, yeah. Whenever I had my first couple speaking gigs, I would always say to myself before I go out there, don't screw up, don't screw up, don't screw up. And my soul or my subconscious would hear, screw up. They would only hear the last piece. So I would mess up. I would get lost. And then I changed it to, you're going to crush it. You're going to crush it. Right. And Tony Robbins has this amazing ritual before he walks out there. Even to this day, he has a ritual to remind himself who he is and what he's about to do and how great it's going to be.
I love that. And that's a really good example of when we repeat something that we don't want to do over and over again, we're more likely to do that thing. So people will be like, well, why'd you write your book about what not to do? Because I think in the grand scheme of life, sometimes it's easier to say, I'm going to get rid of my worst habit, because you already have 10 good habits, but you get rid of your worst one. But if I'm a tennis player and I just keep saying like, hey, you know, don't swing that way, don't swing that way, in your head, you're drilling that in your head. So you want to make sure that you don't just repeat the mistake that you made over and over again. Don't do that thing, because it does, research will show, makes you more likely to actually go do that exact same thing.
So you have a business now that helps people become mentally strong. Do you have any stories of individuals that came to you and maybe they changed some things about how they thought about life, and then it led to financial riches and relationships, better relationships, better family structure, maybe a better job, a better career, better purpose, or a stronger or more clear purpose? Any stories that you can share?
Definitely. I have so many that I could share where people have been able to change the way they think, figure out how do I manage my feelings better, and then figure out what's my action steps. So I had one woman who was completely convinced, I'm just too shy of a person, I'm not outgoing enough, I am not friendly. And so she would say, I go to these networking events and I sit in the corner and nobody talks to me, which reinforced her belief that she wasn't good enough, that she just didn't fit in. So we made it a goal to say, okay, you're going to go to the next networking event and you're going to introduce yourself to five people. I don't guarantee that it's going to go well, but what can you control? You can control whether you smile, look somebody in the eye, shake their hand, and tell them your name and invite them to have a conversation with you. And that slight shift made it so that when she would go to a networking event, that was her goal, not necessarily to get a million phone numbers and meet these amazing people, but she was just going to introduce herself rather than sit in the corner. And within about five events, she said, yeah, now people actually talk to me and I no longer feel like the loser who goes to these events because I'm able to have conversations. It was the belief before that I'm too shy and I'm awkward, and so I would sit in the corner, that really was getting in my way. So once she made that her small behavioral experiment of let's try this, what can you control, introduce yourself, made all the difference in the world. She starts making connections. She's able to build her business and now runs a giant coaching business where she's able to invite people into her space. She's able to confidently coach people. And because she learned all about from these networking events, she learned so much about all of the, you know, basic click funnels and websites and how to have a newsletter and all of the things that she really wanted to do before. But she just kept thinking, I don't fit in. And it was the belief that she didn't fit in that was keeping her from fitting in.
Jeez. So there's an individual who's pretty popular on TikTok and Instagram right now. And she said that if you're dating somebody and you're seeing a certain pattern, you're really not competing against who they dated in the past. You're competing against how their childhood was. And I think that's pretty significant because some things you just can't change about people, especially their childhood. So does that play a factor in how mentally strong people are? Like you said, that this person had this belief that they're just not great at networking events. That might have come from whenever they were 7 years old. Something happened and just triggered it. So the way to fix it is almost have this inner child moment. Go back to that moment, fix it, and then move forward. So is there anything that you've noticed amongst how your childhood really does impact the mental strength?
Oh, absolutely, right? We develop our beliefs about ourselves, other people, and the world when you're like seven. So when you get labeled the whatever kid, whether it's the naughty kid, the loud kid, that sticks in your head. So you might be 40 years old. And I was the shy kid. And so on every report card I ever had, teachers would write things like, she's painfully shy. We never heard her voice. And so for years, and so then I became that person. My friends and my sister always spoke for me wherever we went. So of course, now they find it wildly hilarious that I have a podcast and I can do a TEDx and things like that. But even to this day, my sister came to visit me. I live on a sailboat in the Florida Keys these days. My sister came to visit and we were at a restaurant and it was really sunny. And so she asks the waiter for an umbrella for me because I burn really easy in the sun. Because she still thinks, you know, like you're my little sister who doesn't talk, like I can't ask for something that I need. Because it's really tough to shed those childhood labels of who I am, but also how other people see you. And granted, you can't make other people see you differently, but sometimes it's about knowing, yeah, that's still the like go-to in my head that I'm the naughty kid or I'm not the good at math. And even though you might have evidence to the contrary as an adult, maybe for the last 30 years you were an accountant, but yet you still think I'm not good at math. It's hard to get rid of that, but it's about the self-awareness of knowing, okay, I had this belief for this many years. It sticks in my head. It affected my behavior, but I can still act contrary to it.
Wow. My God. Yeah. You're making me think about all the things that, you know, that happened to me in the past as, you know, when I was starting my business, it was because of the belief patterns that I initiated it. And it was my fault. And so I think that accountability, realizing that everything is your fault, is probably one of the hardest parts about this journey. So have you noticed anything amongst the health profession that kind of drives you nuts that maybe some people aren't taking accountability? Is there anything that you've noticed that maybe we're learning in school or in the therapy world that is actually expanding more problems in their life where maybe they're automatically saying, hey, take this pill or do something that might not be beneficial for you? Are you noticing anything? Because I'd assume you're well-versed in their language, but also because of your ability to communicate this self-accountability and being able to fix it, being around mentally strong people, you might see two different worlds. Is there anything that you'd be able to share with us?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest reasons that our mental health care system is broken is we still don't provide treatment until people are sick. Your health insurance isn't going to cover you to come to therapy to work on the fact that you are struggling with a few things, maybe with rejection or that you emotionally are struggling with certain things. unless you're diagnosed with clinical depression, an anxiety disorder, it's not going to pay for you to come to treatment. And we know that if somebody came in as they were on this journey towards, say, depression, we could prevent so many problems before they start just by educating people on what to look for, what to do differently, strategies that could overcome it. Like exercise is a wonderful thing to combat depression or anxiety. And if we just helped people learn those things early on, it could make a huge difference. And yet, you know, we pay for you to go to the dentist, or people aren't embarrassed to say, hey, I got my teeth cleaned last week, but we don't really have checkups when it comes to mental health. And if we had more checkups for everybody and it wasn't something that anybody were embarrassed about, but it was like you check in with a therapist every 6 months just to say, how am I doing? Is there any red flags I should be looking out for? What could I be doing differently? I think it would make a world of difference and save everybody tons of money on the back end, but also save a lot of people from suffering. So many people go decades before they get help. With anxiety disorders, the average number of years people wait to get help is over 10. People wait 10 years to get help. And once they do, nobody's ever come into my office and said, gee, I wish I would have waited another week. People are always like, I just like wasted a whole decade of my life suffering because I thought that this was normal, or I didn't realize that there was help available. So I think if we all just had regular mental health checkups, the world would be a much better place.
Mm, like that. Yeah. One study I found was the top five characteristics of people who are the happiest in the United States or the world. And one of the characteristics on all of them was they all had a spirituality. They all believed in a higher power, a God. Is that anywhere in your book? Do you believe that mentally strong people, once they realize that if they believe that there's a higher power and that there's a plan or there's something that behind the scenes, that a next life, if you will, that they try harder, they believe there's more meaning to their life? So that might give them a little bit mental advantage. Anything like that you've come across?
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes people will say to me, like, I don't need mental strength. I have God in my life. Well, you still wear a seatbelt in a car, probably, even though you have God in your life, right? Like, we still want to make sure that you're working on yourself. And that doesn't mean that you aren't being spiritual. So I do think it's a huge component. And we know from the research, people who pray tend to worry a lot less, right?
Yeah.
And so just sometimes knowing this is out of my control, yet what can I still do about it? For people who say, well, I prayed about it, it kind of reminds you, like, okay, yeah, I can't control my grandmother's illness, or I can't manage this problem that's going on the other end of the world. But if I pray about it, it gives me some peace. And so I think there is a huge component when it comes to spirituality and knowing, like, what's my purpose? And I think sometimes people think that they have to have a purpose in terms of, I'm going to save the world, or I'm going to grow crops and sell them to some country in another world, or I'm going to do these amazing things to change the planet. But other times people are like, you know, I'm just going to leave the world a little better than I found it. And maybe that means I just smile and hold the door for somebody, or I lend an ear to somebody going through a tough time. And when people have those kinds of beliefs of like, I can make a little bit of a difference today in somebody's life, even if I'm at the bottom of the barrel, like I can still smile. I don't have any money to give. I don't have any time to give anybody, but I could smile at somebody in the grocery store, or I could comment the clerk that's waiting on me. It makes a huge difference. And a lot of people will say, yeah, it's because of my spiritual beliefs that I believe. Cool.
Okay, we're back. There was an issue there, but we have Amy back on the show here. And so my only question, I guess, to kind of wrap things up is, we always ask people, what's a book that maybe changed their life, or maybe a mentor they ran into or met or listened to that put them on this path they're on today? So any books or mentors you'd like to share?
So many books. I do read lots of books. One of my more recent ones that I read is Benjamin Hardy. I love his books, right? Personality Isn't Permanent is amazing. 10X is easier than 2X. Definitely.
That's sitting around here right now. Yeah.
Is it?
I haven't read it yet, though.
It makes so much sense when you read it. Like, oh, yeah, obviously, you don't need to work twice as hard. You just need to come up with better systems and you can grow much bigger and better and faster. So certainly appreciate his book as well.
Nice. And so Jordan Peterson, Tony Robbins, Jim Rohn, do you love all these people?
I do not. there are a lot of people who I think are marketing geniuses, and their mental health information is not on par. We know that 80% of the mental health information, say on TikTok, is harmful, downright harmful, not just wrong, but it is actually harmful. So Plenty of people out there that I think are really, really good at marketing. They have sayings and slogans that sound amazing. However, they're not always solid mental health advice.
Got it. So Jordan Peterson, overall, a thumbs up, thumbs down.
You know, I don't know in his work enough to offer an opinion.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Tony Robbins, not a big fan, huh?
Not the hugest fan of some of the things he says.
Wow. Interesting. Good deal. There's another person I know who's in the mental health world. She's not a fan of Tony Robbins. Pretty wild. So, a website, social media channel. I think you have a very easy to find website that people can, you know, see all your social media and maybe get in contact with you. So what's that website?
Sure. My website is Amy Morin, LCSW, as in licensed clinical social worker.com. And on there, you can find my TEDx talk. My podcast is called Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin, and info on all of my books.
Beautiful. Check it out. Yeah. So guys, look up her book on Amazon, 8,500 reviews. Pretty easy to see how powerful it is and how much it's resonating. So 13 things mentally strong people don't do. Take back your power, embrace change, face your fears, and train your brain for happiness and success. Amy Morin, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Remember, guys, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.